You're listening to Disturbing the Priest with Brandon Baddick.
You know, it's funny. I stumbled across your show a few times, and I was like, just in the back of my mind when I stumbled across metal shows, I'm like, oh, I wonder if I'm ever going to run across, those guys or gals, whoever. And then it wasn't more than a couple weeks later that you reached out to me.
Yeah, when the whole news broke out, I was back and forth with your manager for a little bit. Never really went anywhere.
Oh, okay.
And then I had Mark DeVito on, and I talked to him, and he was like, "Just shoot him a DM." So
right, no, that was the first guy that kind of told me about your show. Yeah, Mark's awesome. He's an amazing guy.
Yeah, man. Yeah, just like the Bay Area stories Mark has are just I could talk to that guy for hours. You know, it's like I was born in 98, so I kind of missed the boat completely.
Yeah, nothing wrong with when you're born, like you get a choice, you know.
Yeah.
But Mark's the prime example of a guy who was there, you know, boots on the ground, and you know, could very well like kind of be like, yeah, I was there. But he's more like, yeah, I was there. You know, like he's just a hella cool man. I fucking love that guy. And he's done a ton of work with us.
Yeah,
he's
man.
Most recent artwork.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Yeah, he told me he was doing some work with some other bands too. I don't think I'm allowed to say it, but very, very exciting. And just the stuff he's done with Motorhead, Metallica. Even the legacy backdrop.
And then Exodus logo, you know, the one that everyone knows today.
Yeah, very exciting. I love your social media presence too. Like I love how active you are. I love like seeing like the music you're sharing and everything. For example, you shared like a King Gizzard song recently. So good, man. I saw them at Red Rocks recently.
Oh.
Fucking amazing. It was so funny because it's like it's such a weird band because you see a guy with like a Grateful Dead shirt next to a guy with a Merciful Fate shirt. And it's like, what by fucking
design.
Band?
All by design. No, that's why I fell in love. Because if you know anything about my career, you know, I've done whatever I wanted. And I wasn't really chasing, commercial success because I think that's almost an impossible fucking dream. And then I come across these guys. I'm like, fuck, they're doing whatever they want. And they're commercially successful in their own way. And they own everything. And they can play whatever kind of music they want all the time. And their fans are accepting them all. That's the dream. Like, so kudos to them to be that one band that actually does it, you know? I mean, they don't miss a beat. And their drummer, speaking of beats, is fantastic. That guy is un-fucking real.
Cavs.
Yeah, great band. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so good. That Petrodratic, Apocalypse, Dragonic, whatever the fuck it's called.
I picked up the vinyl of that one. I have the raised, whatever you call it. Vinyl, where even though it's all bumpy, it's a killer. I love that record.
Other
shit too. I went backwards and I see why they got Grateful Dead fans and you know Prague and then they invented their own little that weird odd tuning that they use with the frets are all different spots.
Yeah,
microtonal tuning. Yeah, I was like, wow. See, I'm just like a fan of that. I'll never, you know, there'll only be one of those. Yeah, they are the fucking unicorn, you know. Nobody else is gonna be able to pull that many genres off and be accepted for it.
Yeah, it's so exciting that like, you know, even in this current day there's still bands, you know, kind of doing their own thing and kind of like being revolutionary in a sense with like a rock basis. Very exciting. Now let's talk some Forbidden. Enough with Gizzard. Very excited, cannot wait to see you guys at Hell's Heroes. An awesome festival that's been going on. I think Tank's going to be on that too. Morbid Saint, a lot of great bands. Are there any specific festivals or show dates that you're most excited for coming up in the new year?
Well, you know, this is going to sound like a cop out, but I'm most excited about the next one for now because reasons I could look forward like into the coming months, but Hell's Heroes I'm really excited about. You know, I'm drinking coffee. You know, they reached out to us and originally asked if we wanted to play with Queensryche for their, when they do the warning, and I'm like, yeah, but that didn't really shake out. So then the Sodom date came up. I'm like, that's cool too, you know, like, because we're direct support for, we're going to be direct support for either one of those, and it's really exciting. I haven't played Houston. I think Forbidden played there in 2010 when Omega Wave first came out, and that was very small with our buddies in oh god, the band from fucking Houston. I'm blanking on their name. Hell. Our friends. I got to look at the flyer. I'm just blanking. And they've been around forever, and they're amazing. Great singer. Anyway, so yeah, they're all playing. And so I'm looking forward to that. But then I start looking down the line, like, you know, I'm looking forward to really looking forward to going to Chile for the Metal Fest in Chile. That was Forbidden's last show in 2012. We played that one. And that lineup is amazing. And we're going to be playing with Biohazard again. And then we do, what is it? We do the, God damn it. My brain's not awake. The same one, the one in Brazil, which is the same one they do in Germany. But anyway, the
Merciful Fate's playing. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, like just my brain usually works, dude. But, you know, I had a late night and I woke up early and then I fell back asleep and I'm waiting.
No worries, man.
I had a little insomnia last night. I'm good. The coffee will start taking fold and then we can really get into the, you know, microcosms.
Totally, man. Yeah, more of a tea guy. I had some black tea this morning. Just goes right through me. I just can't. And there's some good coffee.
That might happen. So.
Yeah, let's pray it doesn't. We might have to do a little bathroom break in the middle of this. Very exciting, man. The rebirth of Forbidden, you know what I mean? I'd love to know, what was that first initial conversation like of the band returning? Can you walk me through that whole process of bringing them back?
Well, I mean, there's the process wasn't really it wasn't a fast one, you know. I mean, it's been kind of, I wouldn't say famously told, but the story's out there now that I was kind of the last guy on board and everybody else was waiting for me to go, okay, you know, like, because I always, like I said earlier, I do my own thing. And, you know, I was rolling with Dressed to Dead for quite a few years. A really great band that just didn't catch a break along the way, and it was about to happen. And some things within the band kind of made me go, okay, you know, this may or may not go down the way I wanted to. And it, right when that all kind of went, it was going down, I got my first emails from Alcatraz Festival asking if we'd be interested in taking Anthrax's spot, because they had dropped off. And the way they presented it to me was so ironic. And it was like, well, you know, because my friend is an organizer, and he's all, you know, I would like you guys to do that, but I know that Russ isn't in really great health right now, so you could possibly do it with another singer. And would you be interested in having Chris Contos play drums? Because he's got such a good legacy out here. And I thought, I already played with Chris and the Boneless ones. You know, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I want to push that envelope, because me and Chris are such good friends. But that was the moment that we'd already, before that, Death Angel was talking to us about doing their Christmas shows. And I was like, I don't know, dude. You know, like, I don't know about that. That's a lot of work. I'm not sure if I want to go there and open Pandora's box. But I was thinking about it and just kind of pondering it without having said yes or no. And then the Alcatraz thing pops up and I'm like, and I was in this very chair and I just pushed my chair back. Well, because the universe is telling me some things. So that was when, you know, I had to go back and I first reached out to Tim, our manager, and said, look, dude, the universe is telling me. And he said, I've been waiting for you to figure that out. So he was the first guy. And then, you know, I called Matt Camacho. You know, we text Russ and we're like, dude, you know, we know you can't do this. You got our blessing, and it was all good there. And so then it was like kind of going around the band, and you know, talk to Steve Smythe, talk to Norman, and I talked to Chris, of course. And I told him, I said, "What would you be interested in doing this or not, or would this maybe risk our friendship?" And he goes, "Man, he's I've been wanting you to do this anyway." He's like, "Just do it, you know." He's like, "We're good, you know. If you need another drummer, cool. But I think it's probably a lot for our friendship to be strained like that on top of everything else we do." And then I was talking to really great drummers and, you know, really, really well known. And everybody wanted to do it because Forbidden's kind of a back pocket influence for a lot of those guys. You know, you may know Gene Hoagland sat in for us our very first shows back in 2008. So, but they were all from out of town. They're all, you know, it wasn't going to be easy. It wasn't, you know, fly in a week before the show to rehearse. Like, none of that's going to work with Forbidden shit because it's way too hard to play. Way too many details. Everyone thinks they know it, but they don't know it until they start playing it. And they realize, oh, shit, you know, that stab there and this, that. And then. So I called Chris back again. I said, before I pull a trigger, dude, let me ask you one more time. Do you want to take a shot at doing this? Or do you want to just see me doing this and playing these festivals and you going, shit, I could have done that too. And he's all, let's fucking do it. So that was the final,
wow,
you know, decision on the lineup. And then the other guys are all, you know, well, you know, we love Chris. How's he going to be? Can he really do this? And, you know, Chris came in like a champ and, you know, learned the stuff, had a ton of anxiety, just freaking out over like each drummer's amazing parts that they played, going from Bo Staff to Jacobs to Hernandez are all phenomenal, you know. And you know, and Mark Hernandez was not an option too, because he left the band when we were on tour in 2011 in Europe at a very, very inopportune time between festival dates, and we had a giant European tour coming like less than 2 weeks later. Where he was doubling because we have Demonica on the bill. So when he quit, you know, even though I was playing with him in Dress of Dead, I always told him, like, Forbidden's not really an option because I don't, you know, his life is just set up a different way with work and everything. So, yeah, so that wasn't an option. So I'm glad Chris became the guy. And each one of those drummers is a tough stool to sit on. You know, each one of those guys is totally unique. And they all had to learn each other's stuff. You know, Mark had to learn both of those guys. And each guy is phenomenal. So Chris is just as phenomenal and has his own way of doing it.
Very, very exciting, man. And especially being like, you know, like we were talking about earlier, my age and everything. I feel like there's a whole wave of Forbidden fans who have never even gotten to see the band live, which is very, very exciting for us. It's been over 10 years since Omega Wave, which is wild.
Right. We just passed 13 years.
Just 13. Wow. It's wild. Wow. 2010 was that far away. It's crazy. Now it's, what is the status on potential new material coming out of the band?
Well, I've been writing, I'm planning on doing a record. That's the ultimate goal is to have a record out, you know, by the end of the first half of 2025. And that's realistic.
Yes. You
know, some people would be like discouraged and they hear, oh, why not sooner? Well, a couple reasons, because everyone wants us to play. And so we have to fucking do some of these shows. Like I'm cool with all the ones we did, but we had to turn down more than we've taken. And,
wow.
You know, you gotta commit to something, and it's going to be really hard to come home from all these shows and work on a record in between it all, but we're going to try, you know. And we have a couple months in June and July where are pretty open where we can work on that. And I also got to start working on the set for Bay Area International at Dynamo, which is a whole different thing. But yeah, there's only so much time in a year. So, you know, this year is going to be spent writing a lot, and hopefully we get in the studio by the end of this year. That's what I'm really hoping, that we can pull it off, you know, like late fall, early winter, and just record through the winter and take it from there. And then just, you know, make sure that everything's got to be right. People would want an album just to come out and, you know, they have like, what about these demo songs? I'm like, oh, this is a different time. It's a different era. So I've been writing a bunch of riffs. Got a, two songs pretty well already put together, and starting to write lyrics, because, you know, that's mostly what I do too. And I'll work with Norm on that kind of stuff, because that's the Norm is the other big part of this, the other, which we didn't really hit too much in the onset of talking about it. But that guy had to be as good as he is and as confident as he is and as unique in his own way, and not try to be like Russ, which was the thing that won me over. You know, he doesn't try, you know, people, he's like Russ. I'm like, but he's not. Like, he's not trying to act like Russ, not trying to necessarily sing like Russ. He'll hit the right notes, but he'll also do it his own way. So that's a big important part. You don't want karaoke I'm not looking for somebody to come in and mimic, you know? So the same is going to go with the lyrical and vocal approach.
Yeah, yeah, and you can't rush shit like that, you know what I mean? And it's like also on top of that, you have the, I think it's like an 8-month period to like get the vinyl pressed. There's a lot that goes into it. Are you looking to have like a full physical release with the new LP?
Yeah, everything.
Everything?
You know, I think we can control that flow now, you know? We're in a position where we can go wherever we want. We've been reached out. Every label that I'd want to deal with has reached out to us. You know, we were originally on Nuclear Blast, but we're not with them anymore, because, and that, which is fucking great.
Oh yeah,
I love Nuclear Blast, but that I don't want to owe them anything. I don't want to, you know what I mean? We're starting fresh. So we could come back and talk to them again, you know. But now we're in a position where that's over here, the new thing's over here, so it's kind of ideal. And I have a lot of confidence in what we're writing and the material, the strength of it, and where this whole thing's headed, the lineup, the guys. I'm confident in them. You know, my confidence is in, I know what I do because I've always done the majority of things for Forbidden, but my real confidence is in that lineup and those people and their heart and souls and all the good shit that make them who they are, which makes me go, okay, we're going to land on our feet just fine. You know, this is the right time with these guys, and they've all been through so much. All of us have. I'm pretty okay with the way things are going to turn out. You know, the world at large, you might not get it out before shit goes sideways. But I've been saying that now for fucking 35 years, and we're still here, you know, rumbling through it. So I have, you know, some sort of hope that we'll follow through, and this record could be a soundtrack to, you know, complete and utter fucking self annihilation and oblivion. You know, hey, what more could a Forbidden album be?
Yes. Very, very exciting. And yeah, unfortunately, that's the times we live in. Like it feels very apocalyptic currently, unfortunately. Now looking at the first release, 1988, up to this one you guys are working on now, looking back at that whole timeline, how much do you feel your creative process has evolved over the years up to today?
Immensely. I mean, dude, you got to figure, like, a lot of Forbidden Evil was written when I was 15, 16, 17, yeah. 18, you know? Uh-huh. And I wrote some of that album with Rob Flynn, and then Glenn came in, and we helped write three songs together with Glenn. But, you know, the other shit, it was, you know, the common denominator is I was there through that. But I was a kid, and it wasn't until we got Tim Calvert in the band that I learned discipline. And Tim, you know, Tim was not a thrash metal guy, and neither was Glenn, but I was, like, fully, you know. Like, so there was this cool thing that happened when Tim came in where there was discipline and structure, and he'd harmonize everything that I did, and it made it, you know, we learned how to, like, build musical moments, musical, you know, emotional peaks and valleys and ebbs and flows together. And he'd never written thrash metal before, so our two styles, we actually worked so well together, and that shit stuck with me. And we, you know, and then we wrote Distortion together in the darkest days of metal. You know, there's just nobody wanted anything to do with thrash metal from 1991 to 1999 or something. I mean, it was like it was just nothing. So when we did Distortion and Green, those were for ourselves. Again, these were not chasing down, like, you're making art at this point because there's not a lot of people interested. So, but I mean, after Forbidden is when I really learned how to write music. and when I was writing all the riffs myself, and everything was, you know, predicated on what I did with Man Made God. And we did an album with Rick Rubin, a tremendous rock record. If no one's heard it, they should. It's on iTunes. Not the band Man Made God, but Man Made God. It was pure, like, classic heavy rock. It wasn't alternative. It wasn't people, you know, it wasn't fucking new metal. Whoever they tried to stick us on tour with, because we were on American. And so I learned a lot through that. And that was where my real songwriting skills and the confidence to do that. I could do that. You know, I could do that myself with great musicians around me. And that was kind of the whole essence of building into being a much better and more rounded storyteller. And so that, you know, so my growth as a songwriter is taking leaps and bounds. And each person I play with is always important and instrumental in it, because they always add their color or their own part, you know. So, I mean, each guy, you know, so when we wrote Omega Wave, I feel like that is a incredibly well-written record. You know, I could say that now, looking back at it, when I played, like, in the fact we left it raw and didn't make it like a clinical, ticky-tacky kind of pro-tooled record, I'm so proud of that, because in the end of the day, when everyone's going through their old records, that one will stand out for being more like the old records than these other ones that are so perfected. And they're like, wow, that sounds amazing. Listen to how tight they are. I'm like, that's cool. But can you play tight like that? Like, and just leave it like you, as opposed to fixing every fucking little thing. I won't do it. So yeah, there's an approach that Forbidden will always take in our recording process too. I mean, quality can get better and better, but I don't want it to be, you know, lifeless and cut to pieces. Oh, uh-oh. My lights just went here. No, that's all right. It's my computer screen.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, man. I have a friend who's a producer in Boston. And he was telling me that about when he first heard 72 Seasons, how it's like everything is, it's almost like they took Pro Tools and cut up every single drum beat and precisely placed everything. Even with the vocals, it's like, he's like, I swear I heard like 50 different takes in one song. And it's like, for a thrash album, like, I feel like that's what you want. You know what I mean? What you're saying.
It is. And this is touchy territory, because you don't want to, like, you know, you're not trying to, there's no right way or wrong way, but there's the way that I like, and there's the way that other people like. And I think what happens is the industry standard of having everything so lined up and so perfect has morphed into people's eardrums. So they think that that's the way it's always supposed to be, when in essence, that's not what magic in music ever was. Not ever, you know, not in any old record we like. But the thing, to be fair with Lars, that was the case going back to Ride the Lightning and Master of Puppets and everything. Like, they would edit, and it's his style. You know what I mean? Like, Lars is like a more of a creative artist than a, you know, he's not, like, you wouldn't consider him like, you know, a virtuoso drummer, and he wouldn't consider himself that either. But he's got ideas, and they're cool.
Yeah.
So it's like picking the best idea. They used to take 2-inch tape and cut it to death before Pro Tools with Lars. I have no engineers that have worked on that stuff, and they just cut apart. Dude, I think on Master of Puppets or Ride Lightning, they didn't even record his cymbals, which happens from time to time. And they went back around and hit cymbals in later. And this is not a diss. This is just a technique.
Yeah.
For me, I played with drummers that are so good that hasn't been, you know, the process. And I always push those guys into getting one good take and making it be the take, you know. And not to say there's no fixes anywhere, but there's so little. You know, every record, like, even on the old days, they'd punch you in. You know, like, you fuck up, they're going to punch you in. But that's how I like it. Like, if you can keep it like that, if you can pretend you're using 2-inch tape when you're using Pro Tools and just punch somebody in and punch somebody out, as opposed to, like, completely moving apart and placing it, you know, that's a discipline.
Yeah, totally, man. And that's so, so interesting to hear. Now, I want to go back to what you were saying about working with Rick Rubin. That must have been nice after the whole thing with his initial interest after Forbidden Evil, right? You finally got to work with him.
And I finally got to, talk to him about that too.
We
did a showcase. His guy came, this is 2001. Beginning of 2001, all the labels, we just did a demo, and almost all the major labels were courting us, but American wanted to come up and see us on like, we'll just come, where are you at? You know, so like, it was like, we're here the next day. So they came in, it was the weirdest thing. This goes back to just the weird, but this guy walks, we're waiting for the guy from the label, and this guy comes to the door. This is old rehearsal studio where there's like a gate on the side, and he's knocking. We let him in. He's all, is this where Man-Made God is? And we're like, yeah. He's like, he's all, guy in my car right now says this is going to be a spectacular night. It's going to be an amazing experience. I'm like, Like, who are you? He's like, oh, I'm his driver. I just wanted to make sure this is the right place. He's really excited. Gonna be some magic happening here tonight. We're like, that was weird. And then dude comes in, it's Dino Paredes, and I didn't know who he was. And a skinny guy in all black suit, like tailored, just like a pallbearer. Uh-huh. And yeah, so but he comes in, and it was magic. We the band had Lightning in a Bottle at that point. We were totally, you know, writing songs, like every day was a new song. It seemed like it was like that real rock, something, you know, that you can't really hit much in your life. This moment was happening with us, and he walked into it. And then then after that, he's like, well, 2 days from now, we're going to fly your equipment to Los Angeles. We're like, wow. What? You know, yeah, we're flying everything. You guys are going to play for Rick. You're doing a showcase. And I wasn't all that interested in being on American. I didn't really care. I don't think anyone did. I think we were all just like, whatever, dude. Like, you know, we'll end up with a home somewhere. Cause this is when major labels were still, you know, pretty strong. And then we ended up doing it and meeting him, and it was an amazing showcase. And as soon as it was over with, me and him started walking out of the room, and I go, yeah, Rick, I don't know if you know, but I was in that band Forbidden. He's, oh yeah. He's, oh, I tried to sign you guys, but your manager just turned me down cold. I'm like, I know. Like, we didn't know until 6 months after you'd even asked. And he's like, really? He's like, wow, that's interesting. And I just said to him, I go, hey, dude, I think we're probably the right fit for each other, you know? And he's like, I think so too. I'm like, then we should probably get it done. He's like, I think so too. And then it was done within 2 weeks. And we were, you know, a month later, we were in LA doing pre-production.
Wow.
So it was just like one of those moments, like a pure belief in oneself, and the self of the project, really. Not just, you know, again, this is the people I was with. They're all amazing. You know, this is two, you know, Steve Jacobs, that was in Forbidden, was in that band as well. And James Walker, my bass player, was phenomenal. And the singer, Pan, was something else. And it was the songs and his voice were the real catalysts, and his lyrics, to making Man Made God what could have been so big that wasn't, you know. It just, yeah, it imploded kind of before our album even came out. It was almost over because we waited 2 years from the day we started recording to the day it came out. Not that we wanted to, but
wow,
the labels were in massive disarray at that time. This is all, you know, you were probably 3 or 4 years old, but in that time there was labels were being gobbled up by each other, and presidents were being shoved off the side. And you guys, they said, can we just wait a few more months to put your record out? And we were so tired of waiting. Well, no, big mistake. Shot ourselves in the foot by just not letting them rework the record one more time before it came out.
Wow. In a way, that must have been nice closure from the Combat days, you know, because like having that whole Rick Rubin thing hovering above you. And now it's like I got to like just talk to him and just from just doing what I want to do, you know.
We spent a lot of time at his house. We'd go up there and work in his music study. And if you ever seen pictures of his study, as that giant bear that's in there, and I'd sit under the bear, you know, and his dogs, wow, would come up. They're like these little dreadlock or big dreadlock fucking dogs, kind of stunk because they had dreadlocks. But he was super nice, and he really did love the band, you know, a lot. And he saw value in what we were doing because it was years ahead of its time, you know, like Rival Sons, like, you know, it was like way beyond, like that's what you can kind of consider it like now, but it was way beyond that because it was true rock. This is a thing, like when you look back at my past, how do you go from thrash metal to this? Well, because I really grew up on the Beatles and great classic rock stuff before I, you know, thrash ever existed. Like music was my lifeline. So it all made sense and it all kind of came together. And it's tragic that it didn't happen, but it was meant not to, because ultimately our singer, who was so great, was also never patient and didn't really understand how this business worked. And he was always unsatisfied. So ultimately it was going to be like pushing an elephant up a hill, and it was too bad, you know?
Yeah.
But some people, if they get too many things given to them too easy at first, then it becomes like, well, it's always going to be like that, right? And no, it's not. It takes work.
it seems like it was such a crazy time too. And on top of that, just everything going on at once, it must have just, you know, it was bound to have happened as it did. Now, we were discussing the combat days. I want to go back to that. I'm curious, how did you guys even get signed to combat initially?
Well, we'd done a demo. Pretty much as soon as Glenn got in the band, we did a 3-song demo of Chalice of Blood, Forbidden Evil, and Marching of Fire. And that got passed around. I gave a copy to Ron Quintana. Ron Quintana played it on his KUSF metal show. Ron's the guy who named Metallica, famously.
Yeah.
He's really the guy who brought Merciful Fate to the Bay Area, or he actually visited Bay first in Denmark. So there's this whole story of him. So he played it, and then people heard it. And then in the meantime, I was reaching out to Debbie Abano, who managed Possessed, and she had never managed another band. And she's like, I don't think I really want to manage bands anymore, but we convinced her to come see us, and then she agreed to manage the band. So, but that she didn't agree. First she saw us, right? Yeah, first she saw us, and then the demo got played. And then Davey Vane, who was the band called Vane out here, said he discovered us because he heard us on the radio. It's like, dude, you heard. But he called Debbie. Wow. He's like, you gotta really work with this band. So this whole thing just kind of bottlenecked into us working with Debbie. And then, you know, a year later, because she kind of kept it slow. She wanted the flow to be slow with us, as you could tell with the Rick Rubin story. She didn't want us to get big too fast. So a year later, we ended up signing to Combat after, you know, them and another 5 other, you know, Roadrunner, Metal Blade, Capitol, somebody else. This all the ones who were trying to do thrash metal at the time. They all kind of reached out to us and were a bit interested, but Combat offered the most money, and us young kids, that seemed like the best thing at the time.
Yeah, definitely. Well, you were like, were you? You weren't even like 20. Yet, right?
No. I was 18 when we went in the studio to record Forbidden Evil. I turned 19 in the studio.
Wow. Jesus.
I was the youngest guy in the band.
Wow.
You know, and I got thrust into the leadership position as soon as Rob had quit to join Violence a couple of years earlier.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a weird spot to be in, dude. And if you would have known me back then, you know, people that have known me a long time have watched me kind of grow up as a human being. But like back then, my head was all over the place. I didn't, you know, I really didn't know how to lead, but I was always the catalyst. So it caused a lot of like friction and resentments. And I learned a lot through my mistakes. You know, that's one good thing about getting it all done early. You know, you learn from your fuck ups and you learn how to keep yourself grounded and all that good stuff.
It must have all been moving so fast too. You know,
it didn't seem like it. It never does when you're young, but looking back in retrospect, it all happens in a blink of an eye.
Yeah. Yeah,
you blink, really you does. Turn, it's gone. You know, it's like it all happened so fast, and I've managed to keep myself, not jaded. I don't ever, you know, like a lot of my peers get super pissed off. A lot of my peers are, you know, really fearful of doing other kinds of music because they didn't want to get, you know, shunned by the thrash metal community. I've avoided that. I've done whatever I wanted. Maybe there's a few like man, 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 but you know, for the most part, if you're writing great stuff, people aren't going to come around saying you're writing shit, you know? So I just write music, and right now thrash is my focus. I feel like the state of the world is perfect for this. It's the climate, literally everything about the climate and the climate of the planet is the perfect timing for Forbidden. So it's all lining up the way it's supposed to be at this point. All the influences of my past, all the rock stuff and other kinds of music I played, it's all going to kind of boil into this new record, which I feel like is going to be across somewhere between Twisted in the Form and Omega Wave to me. I just feel like that's the kind of material I want to fucking put together for this.
Extremely exciting, man. And I feel like that makes the best musicians, you know, like you can obviously have a focus, but pull from as many and listen to as many other genres. You know, I feel like that definitely broadens the mind as a musician. Now, in terms of Combat and that debut record, how did they treat you in terms of like studio time and a budget for that album?
It was quick. I mean, there's a story, you know, it's like 30, I think we got $30,000 to do the record, which at that time was pretty standard. And, you know, studio was like $1,000 a day. So you're blowing through money really quick. The drums took a few days longer. Paul was super particular about himself, and he wanted it, you know, Paul was always phenomenal, but he was, a lot of what people don't know is a lot of his drum fills are improvised in the studio. So if he didn't like one of his improvised fills, it would just like, you know, and there was no fixing, you know, like not really fixing in those days at all. So a lot of that, it just took a while. So we blew through his extra time and we came right up against it. And we barely got it done at the finish line with all kinds of drama between it, but, and we didn't, and when it was done, me personally, I was not like, oh fuck, this album's gonna fucking rock the world. I didn't know. I was like, I'm not, you know, because I wasn't there when they did vocals because they didn't pick me up that day. Long story. Don't want to get into it, but I hated the vocals as soon as I heard them. I was like, what the fuck? And
wow.
I got used to them, but I'm like, this could have been so much better. Twisted a turn and this word. Why did you change those words there? And nobody checked you on this. Like, you know, I was so bummed. It took me a while, but I remember they were talking about giving us really small ads, quarter pages, and then the album cover was done, and that blew everyone's mind. And then the fucking reviews started coming back from the press, and those were so good that the label's like, "Huh, change your mind. You're going full page back cover every bag." So we had the full page back cover of everything,
like Kerrang. Rip.
Yeah, well, Kerrang, I'm not sure, that's, you could be Europe. I think those were half page ads, but in the US, like every major Hit Parader, Circus, Metal Maniacs, you know, like all of them, we were as soon as you picked it up, there's Forbidden Evil cover. So it was the music and it was the art and the timing, and you know, we were on our way, you know. Then when Twisted in a Form came out, it got even better for us, you know. Same kind of budget, might add $5,000 more, you know, same kind of thing, just getting it done by the time, with skinnier teeth. I think that's the way a lot of great records were made back then, you know, keeps it edgy.
Totally. How soon after writing the debut did you start working on Twisted into Form?
Very soon. And that I was started writing a couple of songs with Calvert before he was actually in the band. I started throwing around ideas, One Foot in Hell and Step by Step, thinking that he probably is going to join the band, but Glenn might have had a chance to save his job, and we went to Europe and that didn't happen. So by the time we came home, we let Glenn know that he was gone, and then Tim was playing a show with us a week later at the Omni because he'd already been doing the work, and we're like, oh shit. So we'd had a couple, I believe it was Step by Step and One Foot in Hell, and they weren't done. And then we as soon as we finished, because right after we got Tim, we immediately went on tour with Exodus, and then we went on tour with Sacred Reich, and we did the Exodus and Sacred Reich in the US, and then we immediately came home and started writing, and we're just like, okay. And then we're in the studio January, the day of the Super Bowl when the 49ers played in 1990 against the Denver Broncos. We were loading in the studio through the back to the soundstage room at Fantasy, where they do you know, they have all this, you know, you could walk and do all the sounds for movies. So we're walking on a big screen TV, which is way different back then. It had three little projector lights. But we were watching that game, and it seemed like every time we walked in with a piece of gear, we'd scored again. And because me and Paul were big Niner fans. Everyone else, there's two other guys, Raider fans. Russ didn't give a shit. But so it was like we only really had seven songs besides the instrumental stuff that we'd written ready, you know? And so those seven songs are Twisted into Form, plus Parting of the Ways and Spiral Depression.
Yeah.
So not a lot of songs, but the quality was good enough, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I'd say definitely. Now in 94, we got Distortion, which saw the band's sound going in a more heavier direction. How do you reflect on that? Was that like a more conscious choice, or was that a subconscious choice in your writing?
I think it was both. I really think, and I kind of alluded to it half an hour ago, you know, just we were writing for ourselves at that point, because we knew that it wasn't, you know, we weren't going to end up in the same kind of situation. We knew the United States didn't have room for bands like us. Really, they didn't give a fuck. So we were more writing for ourselves and knowing that we were going to score a record deal in Europe. And that's exactly what happened. And I think, you know, it's a matter of like what you're listening to and the growth that we had. Tim and I were becoming much better guitar players. The band was becoming better. I mean, and honestly, you know, once Paul left and Steve came in, there was a whole stigma like, oh yeah, they're not going to be shit without Paul, which is actually pretty laughable looking back at it now. It's like, he was great with us for those two records, but we were just fine. And Steve Jacobs was an incredible drummer who, because his name wasn't Paul Bostaph, people were, you know, coloring in the lines with their own. But Steve was, I mean, he made us fucking incredibly tight. It was, you know, so the band was actually better, you know. And that's not just because Paul was gone. It's because 4 years and everybody got better. So, you know, and you just don't know how things are going to go, but you just write music because it's what you want to hear and what you want to play. It was more technical. It was really, really hard stuff. Like, it was difficult. It was more progressive in a way, and it was heavier, and it was more everything, you know? But it came at a weird time, and, you know, in Europe, I think it went over really good. In the United States, a lot of people didn't even know it came out. But yet we toured the States with Testament on Low, which was another album that was good, but nobody gave a fuck about at the time. And then Malevolent Creation, which was fun, but that wasn't like the ultimate perfect pairing, you know. We toured Europe, which was even weirder. And but they were good, and they were going through their like death metal rock and roll phase. So they were a little ahead of the program, to be honest with you. I think they were like, they were running up ahead of or, you know, on par with Carcass in that way, you know, rock and roll kind of fucking, which was cool, you know, good band.
Yeah, yeah. I think Distortion and Green are both great albums. Now, you were on Gun Records for the Making Distortion. What was your relationship with that label?
Well, they were into it, man. I mean, that's the thing. They loved what we were doing, and they put, you know, a lot of promotion into the European end of things, and you know, it was a really good push at the time. You know, still fighting that same stigma of the timing, because there's a lot of yo-yo metal happening. You know, Biohazard was coming up, which at the time, you know, you know these are all friends of ours too, but you know, Machine Head and Biohazard and even Slayer was like, you know, everything was kind of like for this, and we weren't, and so we were kind of going against the grain, considered dinosaurs at that time, which is hilarious because this is 30 fucking years ago now, right?
Like, I know, yeah.
You know, what am I now, you know? But, yeah, so it was, you know, I was in my 20s. You know, it's fucking wild. And 26 when we were doing that shit.
Wow.
25. So I was still young, what I would consider fucking juvenile now. And, yeah, just... Once we got home and did the U.S. stuff from Distortion, we were even more motivated and pissed off to write a really angry record. Like, we just, you said, let's just write the most fuck you album for Forbidden. Like, more, I always call it our caveman record, because it was just, the approach was just so like, and that kind of, Tim wasn't as involved in Green. He was a little bit, he wasn't really a thrash dude. And he loved bands like Queensryche and whatnot. And, but I mean, you know, he contributed and he wrote some really killer shit for it, but he wasn't like, that was mostly Steve Jacobs and I pounding out these riffs, these monster fucking anger riffs that I had, and said, let's just fucking, yeah. And then we did it. And then the label, when it was all done, they were just like, whoa, what do we do with this? Like, this is not like your last album. I'm like, no, it's fuck you album. And they were scared. And then they made the mistake of not knowing what to do with it, and then say, well, we have a tour for you in Europe with Manowar. And I said, no, thanks. That was my moment. That was my exit strategy. I was like, we have finally hit the precipice. I don't want to push my way through a Manowar tour playing shit that people don't understand. You know, like, I realized that was our goodbye letter, and it didn't go over really well for years. And I didn't understand what an impact that album had on people till I came back around with Man Made God, and people were coming up to me from other bands like, you know, Shadows Fall or, you know, Slipknot or these other things, going, dude, Green is like fucking, you know, Lamb of God, guys, like that, you know. But you'd hear it in Slipknot, like you hear the little, there's just like little things they did. And Joey Jordison said it was his, one of his biggest riff influences, because he wrote a lot of those riffs on his first couple Slipknot records. So yeah, I didn't know. And that was a clue to me, like, oh, I guess maybe people do care a little bit about Forbidden. And then, you know, years later, I mean, I was doing different shit and I had no idea.
That's so funny to hear, man. I was actually going to ask what your mindset was during the making of that record, because you guys seem so pissed off in literally every element, from the lyrics, the vocals, the playing. Now, I like, that makes a lot of sense hearing that from like the Lamb of God guys and stuff. I feel Green has a little bit of a groove element to it, and some like groove metal. What's your opinion about more groove oriented riffs in Forbidden's music?
I like groove. I'm a guy with rhythm, you know. And when you're playing thrash metal all the time, you really, you're constantly fighting ahead of the beat. You're constantly ahead, and I have a natural inclination to make things that make me want to fucking dance. You know what I mean? So
yes.
adding groove to it is like, it's, some people say it's a bad word. Those people are usually, rhythmically challenged. You know, like. I didn't look at it like groove metal. I just like, I fucking, and having Steve Jacobs just instantly made us groovier, because he just took all of our songs, and I call it egg shape, where it goes, it kind of comes down heavier.
Yeah, comes down interesting.
Like so I always call it that, and that's, you know, maintaining the egg. And I brought that to Mark Hernandez when he joined the band, and once he understood, and then, you know, and with Chris, he's just fucking master of groove. You know, Chris is like just the solidest fucking groovinest drummer I've ever played with, you know. So like that'll always be there. You can't make things as quirky. Like people are like, if I say, well, you can't really write Forbidden Evil again, they'll see, you never can. It's like, no, because we fucking were literally clueless, just wrote crazy cool things that just slapped on top of each other and got lucky, you know. Like, it's not, you can't reproduce, you know, your 15, 16, 17 year old self. And nobody can, and nobody should try, because that's premeditated. That would be a concocted fucking idea that, you know, it's not organic.
Yeah. And I feel like every Forbidden album like stands up on their own 2 feet. You know what I mean? And I would hate if a band just kept retreading the same water. Now, I know something that happens a lot is bands re-record old records. Would you ever have any interest in that with any old Forbidden stuff?
No. There were times I thought about that, because I don't like the production value as much of the old shit. But one thing I've learned through other people's mistakes is never go back and try to reimagine what people nostalgically fucking hold on to. If they liked it, then why go back and try to improve it? Because you're not actually improving anything. Sure, the sound quality can be better, but you're never going to catch that same energy. I think there's the idea that you could re-record them just so you could put it out and make money off of it, which is, you know, because somebody else is making money off your old stuff. I get that. But I'm not interested in chasing that down. You'll see live versions of these songs, you know, like the way we're going to release a bunch of the songs that we did at the two Death Angel shows, because we have multi-camera shoots, multi-tracks. We can go
awesome.
In, we can mix it, and that'll be how you see the old shit, you know, played now. And that's only going to get better as we play more together, because we've only been together now. Jeez, what did we start? I don't think we started even rehearsing until, I want to say May of last year.
Wow.
So, and then we were in, you know, Europe by August. So, I mean, it's only going to get better.
Yeah. Very, very exciting, man. Now, are you, you're talking about production, and I know you co-produced Omega Wave. Are you going to handle the production on this new release too?
I'm definitely going to be, Yeah, I'm handling. You know, yeah. I mean, I'm willing to work with somebody else. Zach Oren, I want to engineer it. Zach is did all the stuff for Machine Head most recently, but he also worked with me on the Dress the Dead stuff, and he's fucking one of the best engineers. And you know, he's a fucking amazing genius savant guy. He's fucking incredible, and he's right here in Oakland, so. That'll be good to work with him as an engineer, because that'll keep things fucking right on top of it, and he'll have the performances with me. And but the creative shit and the ear candy and all the things that I want to hear and the way that I like, you know, my subliminal messages to be, that's I gotta be able to control the flow on that. And Chris is also a great great ear for production as well. His dad was a famous producer, actually. And he's, so it's fun to get ideas from him, but it's mostly going to be me and who he handed off to mix it. It's going to be the big part. Like, who's going to be the guy that's going to mix this thing and, you know, maintain the vision and integrity of what it is we're trying to do.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to hear it, man.
I have questions about that. Cause there's a lot of people that want to do it. But it's gotta be the right fit, and they got to understand that I want it to sound raw and alive. And a lot of producers or mixers, quite frankly, not that they don't know how to do it, but they wrestle with it, because like I said, the industry standard, maybe somebody at a label will say, well, it needs to sound like this, and that's not going to fly. So we're going to control all of our own narratives from here on out. We're not going to let anyone tell us, you know, how exactly things should be done, what it should sound like, and we'll sign to the label that gives us creative freedom to get it done the way we want it done, because we want this record to sound good 30 years from now and alive, and not like a fucking droning perfected, you know, typewriter.
Yeah, well, as a fan, that's probably the best thing to hear. Honestly, very, very exciting, man. And I cannot wait to hear how this sounds. Now, Forbidden, we're in the fourth wave of thrash metal right now.
Is it?
It's the fourth wave. Do you have any thoughts on some of the bands in this wave and just the current state of the genre? You've seen it go up and down so many times. I'm curious what you think about the genre currently, as well as like, where do you see it going in the future?
Well, at this point, it's hard to imagine a world without thrash metal in it, and I think that it's going to maintain its niche until something else comes along. But really, the reason why people go backwards and try to do the old shit is exactly what I said, because those albums were recorded in such a way where you captured the spirit of those bands, and you have a hard time recapturing that spirit if you try to do it the modern way, right? So, a lot of these newer bands. There's some really good ones. We have one out here called Frolic, who's up and coming. It's really good. Killer, they've gotten better each time I see them, and they're young. They're in their early 20s, you know, and they're like, you know, what Warbringer was a few years ago, Havoc, like they're cool. Upcoming like that. Got Cool and Phantom Witch from up here, who if they get on the right track, they're going to be going down that road as well. And so, you know, there's quite a few. And I really do like Havoc and Warbringer a lot, but that's like 10 years ago, 12 years ago. So I guess that's the third wave of thrash. And, you know, I'm not really overtly familiar with all of the newer thrash bands, but one thing they're all really trying to do is emulate shit that was going on in a completely different fucking century and, you know, different. It was way back then, and they're trying, you know, down to their high top, you know, sneakers, to do it the way it was done, which is totally cool. But you know, the word that needs to fucking stick with people that is a lost fucking word, and or even distorted in translation, is authentic. Like authentic, you know, for instance, I'll give you a great example. There's a band of kids. They're a vehicle. They're talented kids. They're a vehicle for their father, who's a producer, and they do a bunch of covers, and they're super well produced. And there's, you might, they have a girl singer. You might know who I'm talking about. and they're young and they do things, and they recently did a Dio song and the girl's singing it, and it's just all this dramatic, like this and that and the other, you know, like really. And I'm just looking at it going, no, like, no, you're too young to even act like that. Like, you haven't lived enough life to really relate to those fucking words the way Ronnie did and the fucking life that he lived, because he was authentic. And, you know, you can, there's an old fucking phrase from a commercial, you can't fake the funk on a nasty dunk. You know, it's an old commercial from the 80s or maybe early 90s. And it's just, it's the thing. And I don't want to sound like a curmudgeon, because I'm not, because I'm really open-minded. But you can tell if you ask yourself and you're really listening, is that authentic or is that somebody acting like something and not quite getting the authenticity of it all? And I think that that's what bands need to really look out for, and relate to what they relate to. You know, don't try to relate to what we related to. Relate to what they relate to and make that your fucking precipice. You know, or what you stand upon is what you're going through in your fucking way. And, you know, I think a lot of bands try to make things sound too much like it was from the 80s. There's a lot of bands that really lean into that early new wave of British heavy metal. I think that's the easiest one to emulate.
Yeah.
You know, like everything's like a lot of playing on the A string and which is killer. And there are some bands that do it great, like Hellfire, fucking great. And there are some bands where I'm just like, yeah, but no. You know, you could tell. I mean, it's just different. Hellfire is another band I really like, and they lean in that direction. But man, they're authentic. Like you could feel their authenticity, maybe because they're in their early 30s and just a little more connected to it. I don't know.
Yeah. I find that in a lot of bands where a lot of it, where it's so identical to maybe like British New Wave, where it's like, I think I'd rather just listen to Jaguar or something, where there's bands today where it's like, yeah, they have that, but they're also bringing something new to the table, where it's like, that's why I really like listening to them. And it's happening. And in thrash, you get kind of both of that. But I think it's kind of the growing pains of this new wave we're in right now.
It's a sign of time. You can't necessarily get mad at people about it, because, you know, it's just like movie making or any other art form. You know, you're always emulating something, but the threat of authenticity cannot be understated. It's the thing that makes magic, as opposed to just, you know, noise. If you got to relate to what you're fucking doing. I say that with like the utmost respect for anyone who's trying, but it's the one thing you've got to dig deep within yourself to say, this is, I'm doing it for this reason. I want to fucking present these, you know, a lot of lyrics also don't really have a deeper meaning to them. I mean, some bands, that's fine. You know, like not every band, you mentioned a band like Jaguar, like, not every band wrote the deeper lyrics, you know.
Yeah,
it's fine. There's a place for that, but for me personally, the lyrics have to mean something on a deeper level. The music has to, tell the story that goes with the lyrics, so that they work hand in hand together. And there's actually, you know, a picture being painted in your mind, your picture, you know, what you see in your mind. So that's when it's authentic to me. Like when you can use your imagination, really paint the picture. And metal is the ultimate, for that.
Like
that
canvas.
Singer, songwriter, acoustic songs. You know, it's like,
yeah, yeah.
Those are the two best like genres to do that kind of storytelling.
Yeah. So funny. The two best. Very cool, man. This has been great. Now, as we wrap up here, I'm just curious, what's the best way for fans to stay updated with everything Forbidden?
Oh, just our IG page is really new. I think we put that up in April or something. So, you know, that needs to grow. We never had an IG page until fucking April of last year. So, but also the Facebook page is got a nice healthy following on there. And you can just, yeah, IG and Facebook. And then there's also officialforbidden.com for merchandise. And we'll put big news, like big sweeping points up there. But most people use social media. We don't use Twitter / X or or TikTok or sorry.
Like, it's not worth it.
It's not for us. Yeah. It's just like, we don't need to cater to that end of it. If when we're on a label, you'll know how to find us. And in the meantime, you know, just keep your eyes open for these shows that are few and far between. We can't play everywhere. Sorry, fucking Kansas. You know, everywhere that we want to get to you eventually, but we got to prioritize. Writing an album is the priority one right now.
100%, man. Craig, thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it, man.
Hey, no problem. It's a cool show. I've watched a few interviews and you did good work. Yes, good questions.
I appreciate it. I try my best. Now, this has been awesome, man. I'm Brandon Baddock, and this is Disturbing the Priest.